Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, Belgium is rocked by apparent terrorist attacks.
Border security measures have increased. There have been more restrictions being placed now on public transport, reinforcement of military presence at several sites, including the Brussels airport.
We'll also hear what is being said on social media about this story. An analyst considers the improvement of relations between Cuba and the U.S. and a new unexpected development in the Apple iPhone FBI standoff. It's right here on The Voice of America. At least three explosions rocked Brussels today. Reporter Luis Ramirez is joining us on the line right now with details, our European correspondent. Luis, what do we know about this story so far? It's very fluid, but what do we have for sure?
Well, we have certainly the Belgian Prime Minister calling it a very tragic day, a dark day in Belgian history. At least three explosions, as you mentioned, claiming a great loss of life here. The confirmation is from the Belgian federal prosecutor that at least one of those explosions was caused by a suicide bomber. Reaction across the continent has been very quick. France, for one, saying that it is deploying an additional 1,600 police to its borders, to its transit points. Britain also beefing up security quite substantially. The bigger question down the road is, what will Europe now do to ensure that Belgium is able to protect Europe's security? Brussels, of course, being the headquarters of NATO and the European Union.
And it's also a very densely populated city.
It is very densely populated. Remember that on the Christian calendar, this is Holy Week, which in Europe means a lot of people are on vacation. Although the city has been on alert for several months now, really since the Paris attacks, Brussels has not been one of the vacation destinations of choice. Nonetheless, that meant for a very busy airport.
Well, this comes after a significant arrest in connection to that Paris shooting you just mentioned.
These attacks in Brussels follow the arrest of one of the main figures in the Paris attacks. Clearly in Brussels were coordinated attacks. There are no connections at this time being made between him and the attacks in Brussels. What is clear to security officials in the early hours after these attacks is that there is possibly more than one, likely more than one network operating that would be capable of carrying out these attacks. There is also a concern that the man who is believed to be the main bomb maker in the Paris attacks is still at large and that he may be in Brussels and may have participated. That's just one possibility that authorities right now are exploring.
Perhaps you'll refresh our listeners' memories about that Paris shooting and what happened there.
Well, that incident certainly shook Europe for years to come. There were a number of coordinated attacks, the worst one being at the Bataclan Theater as a concert was going on. A heavy metal band from the United States was playing, and that concert hall in Paris is where the largest loss of life occurred when gunmen went into the theater as the concert was going on, opened fire. Killed scores of people, largest loss of life there. At about the same time, we had a series of explosions going off at the Stade de France, which is a large stadium on the outskirts of Paris. There was a football match going on at that time, which, by the way, President François Hollande was among those attending. He was quickly taken out and unhurt. Nobody inside the stadium was hurt. In addition to the attacks at the stadium, there were other attacks at bars and restaurants in various parts of the city, all taking place at about the same time. These attacks, the perpetrators were traced to Belgium, to Brussels, as a matter of fact, where many of the logistics aspects of the attacks were planned. As I mentioned earlier, the bomb maker is believed to have actually created the devices that were used in the explosions at the stadium. So deep connections to Brussels. The city has been under alert for quite a few months. This is not a terrible surprise to many people, but at the same time, many would wonder why it would happen when the city is already on alert.
I've heard many people compare the attack in Paris for the French to 9/11 for us here in the United States.
In a country the size of France, that is probably a good comparison. The sheer magnitude of this having hit right in the center, right in the heart of the French capital, shook the country. To this day, till very recently, I was in Paris, still see the flowers piled up outside the Bataclan Theater at the Place de la République. So this really hit the heart of France in the same way, in a similar way, that the Brussels attack is hitting the heart of Belgium and, by extension, the heart of Europe.
Yes, and we heard the Belgian Prime Minister today. He came out rather quickly with an announcement.
The Belgian Prime Minister and was joined by a number of members of his government to make an announcement not long after the explosions, and he announced that border security measures have increased. There have been more restrictions being placed now on public transport, reinforcement of military presence at several sites, including the Brussels airport. Basically, at this point, no flights leaving or arriving at Brussels airport. The rail connections to the city also have been suspended temporarily. There are checkpoints set up around the airport and around the city, restricting the traffic. So the announcement from the Belgian Prime Minister included a call for solidarity and an appeal for calm. He said, "I'd like to make an appeal to people to stay as calm as possible, but also show their solidarity, remain united at these difficult moments."
Well, thank you very much, Luis Ramirez, our European correspondent.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists was able to find hundreds of nearby galaxies that had been hidden by the dust and stars of the Milky Way. This gave them some new insight into a mysterious astronomical anomaly some 150 million light years away. Writing in a new study, the group says a third of the 883 galaxies they found behind our home galaxy have never been seen before. The study's lead author, Lister Stavely-Smith from the University of Western Australia, said that while the Milky Way itself is very beautiful and interesting, it completely blocks out the view of the more distant galaxies behind it. The scientists say their discovery may also help explain a phenomena called the Great Attractor, which is described as a region of space that seems to be pulling ours and hundreds of thousands of other galaxies toward it with a gravitational force that's tens of thousands of times more powerful than that of the entire Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Brussels blasts, of course, have been a big issue in social media today. And our social media reporter, Andrew Palchevsky, has joined me here at the anchor desk with a look at what's going on. Andrew, what are they saying?
Well, it's a top topic around the world, these Brussels attacks, as more information comes in. But within Brussels, social media is playing a very valuable role. A lot of the cell phone lines are either jammed or down in the city, and so a lot of people are turning to social media to check in with family and friends to let them know that they're okay. In fact, Facebook's activated what they call their check-in feature. Now, this is something, if you're in the area, a box will pop up when you log into Facebook and it'll say, "Are you in the area and are you okay?" And if you are, it'll allow you to notify your friends and family. So this is very valuable for people, again, who don't have cell phone access, but also a way to notify a large number of people, not having to text individual people or call individual people. You can kind of send it en masse via Facebook.
And I understand pictures are also getting out through social media.
Even faster than the news agencies. We're seeing, in fact, the news agencies are using a lot of the pictures that people, just bystanders in the airport. Everybody these days has a smartphone, and so they take out those phones, they're filming, they're taking photos, and that's what's making its way to the news from these firsthand people who are on the scene. So Facebook and Twitter, getting that information out, is also playing a very important role as this terrorist attack unfolds in Brussels.
And I understand you had a friend who actually used social media to let you know that he was all right.
Yeah, I have a friend who lives in Brussels. Fortunately, he was in the U.S. He's in the U.S. this week. But that was, again, like many people are doing, went to social media and said, I'm okay. Thanks for everyone for their concern. So that kind of information being spread on social media is important. Also, we're seeing people who are on the scene, in addition to the photos and videos, sharing their firsthand accounts. I saw one person who was actually on a plane that was diverted to a different airport after the bombing at the Brussels airport and was giving kind of a live feed of what was happening, what the passengers were doing. So you kind of get a glimpse into how people are reacting in all facets, not just in Brussels, but really around the world.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew. Appreciate that. Coming up on International Edition, President Obama continues his historic visit to Cuba and a development in the iPhone hacking controversy. President Obama's historic three-day visit to Cuba ends today with a meeting with dissidents watching a U.S.-Cuba baseball game, and in a rare concession by the communist government, addressing the Cuban people on state-run television. The White House says the speech will offer a vision of warmer bilateral relations following more than a half century of Cold War animosity. Those tensions were on display during a joint news conference Mr. Obama conducted Monday with his Cuban counterpart, Raul Castro, the 84-year-old younger brother of Fidel Castro, especially when it came to disagreements over human rights and democracy.
I've said consistently, after more than five very difficult decades, the relationship between our governments will not be transformed overnight. We continue, as President Castro indicated, to have some very serious differences, including on democracy and human rights. And President Castro and I have had very frank and candid conversations on these subjects. The United States recognizes progress that Cuba has made as a nation. At the same time, as we do wherever we go around the world, I made it clear that the United States will continue to speak up on behalf of democracy, including the right of the Cuban people to decide their own future. We'll speak out on behalf of universal human rights, including freedom of speech and assembly and religion. Part of normalizing relations means that we discuss these differences directly. So I'm very pleased that we've agreed to hold our next U.S.-Cuba human rights dialogue here in Havana this year. Even as we discuss these differences, we share a belief that we can continue to make progress in those areas that we have in common.
Mr. Castro, unaccustomed to taking questions from the news media, showed flashes of anger when pressed about how many political prisoners there are in Cuba. Give me a list right now of political prisoners so I can release them, he says. What political prisoners? Give me a name or the names and we will release them before the night is through, he said. He also bristled about human rights, insisting that no country complies with every category of human rights. University of Miami history professor and Latin American expert Jaime Szuszalik tells VOA's Victor Beatty the awkward chemistry between the two leaders underscores what he calls the still cold bilateral relationship.
Raul Castro did not receive the president as is customary at the airport. So I think that the president is aware that Cuba is standing on their position and that no matter what, how many concessions the U.S. is giving, Cuba remains an unfriendly ally, let's put it that way.
Mr. Castro was put in a rather awkward position taking questions from the press. He's not accustomed to that.
No, he's not a question. And the question of Jim Acosta was how many political prisoners do you have and when you're going to release him and that kind of stuff. He's not used to that kind of question.
So it looks like we have a long way to go in this relationship.
Oh, we definitely have. Look, despite the normalization and the opening of the embassies, Cuba has not opened up politically in Cuba at all. It has made some economic changes, but no political changes. Furthermore, Cuba remains an ally of Russia, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela. So Cuba's foreign policy, if anything, has hardened with the normalizations of relation, and Raul Castro does not seem willing to offer any significant concessions.
Does this give you a sense, this news conference that was held today, that Cuba is really not embracing this newfound relationship with the U.S.?
Well, they're embracing it very carefully and only to obtain whatever they want. Raul Castro emphasized again that he wanted the return of the Guantanamo naval base, and that he wanted lifting of the embargo. So he still has two major concessions that he wants from President Obama. And Obama has been clear that, well, this may happen under a different administration, but this is probably as far as he's willing to go.
The president, Mr. Obama, I'm referring to, has hailed his visit as a new day for U.S.-Cuba relations. Is this a new day, or do we have quite a ways to go?
It may be a new day and the beginning of a 10-year process. I don't see this as a changing very quickly.
Do you sense that his critics saying that the president, Mr. Obama, has given away too much in this relationship and received so little, is there some reason to believe that that is a correct position?
I think that that is very correct. I think the president went into this with the idea that, well, he's going to be nice to Raul Castro and he's going to give him some concessions and Raul Castro would turn around and become a friendly partner with the U.S. He's done the same thing in Iran, and we've seen how the both things have turned out.
Aimé Shulecki describes the opening of relations with Cuba as premature, without first conducting tough negotiations leading to major Cuban concessions on issues such as human rights and political reform. He sees little chance for advancement in ties with Havana, such as ending the 55-year-old U.S. trade embargo, without further Cuban concessions. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
The fishing industry in Mauritania accounts for up to 10% of its gross domestic product. But local fisherman Baro Diop worries his livelihood is in danger.
There are big boats that stop here coming from the sea, big trawlers that destroy the seagrass. And the seagrass these trawlers destroy is where the fish live.
A new global initiative, though, aims to push for more sustainable fishing practices and keep track of the world's fish stocks. Jacqueline Alder is with the Food and Agriculture Organization.
The Fishing Transparency Initiative will help to improve governance by looking at who has the right to fish, how much it costs to fish, and how much they catch.
According to the Fishing Transparency Initiative, overfishing is threatening much of the world's fish stocks. Once governments sign on to the voluntary initiative, as Mauritania has done, they must adhere to guidelines for gathering and disclosing information about their fishing industries. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbeat.
In a surprising move, lawyers for the U.S. Department of Justice have persuaded a federal judge to stay a hearing that had been scheduled for today in the FBI Apple legal standoff. And also, the FBI is suggesting it might have a way to unlock a terrorist's iPhone without Apple's help. International Edition's Doug Bernard joins me here in the studio. He's our social media expert. Hi, Doug.
Good morning.
What is this all about?
So you may recall we've been reporting for some time that a federal judge had ordered Apple to essentially create a software patch to allow the FBI to break in to a phone that it says was used by one of the San Bernardino terrorist shooters, that shooting back in November of last year. So today, the hearing was scheduled for today. This Apple and the FBI had both been filing their legal arguments. We weren't expecting a ruling, but this was a big hearing. Then with less than 24 hours to go, the Department of Justice persuaded the judge not only to cancel the hearing, but to stay her order that basically forced Apple to create this software patch to break into its phone. The reason why, well, when you go through those court filings, the FBI now says that it has found a third party that it believes can break into the phone without Apple's help.
And we don't know who that is.
No, we don't know who that is, and we don't know the technique that's going to be used. The FBI has asked for a 2-week test period. They want to make sure that this technique works, and then they would apply it to the phone that's in their possession.
Well, this was also controversial because Apple folks were saying that to break into their own phones is a privacy issue, and they don't want to lose that. Maybe you could talk to us about that.
Sure. So the argument Apple had been making was that this isn't just breaking into one phone, that if they created this, if they were forced to create this software patch, it would create the precedent, the legal precedent, that it would have to start breaking into, you know, potentially anybody's phone here in the United States, maybe in Russia, maybe in China, anywhere. They did not want that at all. That would have just been a terrible business business.
Because their customers are counting on them not to do that.
That's exactly right. So that had been their argument all along. The FBI's argument all along had been that it just doesn't possess the ability to break into the phone without Apple's help. So what's curious now is what this new legal filing means. I mean, what does it say now if the FBI says, oh, well, actually, you know what, maybe we can break into this phone? This really raises questions about why the case was brought in the first place and why the FBI is backing off now.
And, you know, you might think that you could just sit down with this terrorist phone and punch numbers into it until you turn blue in the face, but that's not the case.
Not at all. So there's a little bit of software on this iPhone, on everybody's new iPhones, that basically gives you 10 chances to unlock that phone. There's a certain limited number of possible combinations, but you only get 10 chances. After the 10th incorrect entry, all of the data on that phone is permanently destroyed, and that's a real thing. I mean, there's no recovering that once it happens. So the FBI doesn't want that. They want to be able to get into that phone. The interesting thing is it seems the FBI was really wanting the court to set the legal precedent that it could ask for this and demand it. The fact that they're pulling back now is raising the question in some people's minds that maybe they didn't think they were going to get that legal precedent, so now they're backing off the legal challenge.
Well, thank you so much, Doug, for coming by and explaining all this to us. And I know you'll be keeping an eye on this story.
You bet.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. And if you would like to listen to today's program again, visit our website, voanews.com. Thanks for joining us today for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Safe drinking water is fundamental to healthy lives and prosperous communities. To focus attention on the importance of clean water and to advocate for the sustainable management of freshwater resources, on March 22nd of every year, we observe International World Water Day. Every person needs at least 20 liters of water per day for drinking, cooking, sanitation, and hygiene needs alone. Yet some 2 billion people worldwide do not have access to safe drinking water, and more than 2.4 billion people do not have access to improved sanitation for adequate disposal of human waste. People who do not have access to clean water and sanitation are at greatly increased risk of infectious diseases, which can lead to physical and cognitive impairments and premature death. Contaminated water and poor sanitation are among the main causes of severe diarrheal diseases in the very young, the second leading cause of death in children under 5 years old. According to the World Health Organization, or WHO, some 760,000 young children die of diarrheal diseases across the world every year. It is further estimated that as few as 5 incidences of diarrhea in children under the age of 2 can lead to lifelong effects, such as developmental delays and stunting. Clearly, an adequate supply of safe water and access to basic sanitation are the most basic necessities of life. But the importance of clean water goes so much further than the assurance of hydration and cleanliness. This year's theme for the United Nations World Water Day is Better Water, Better Jobs. The slogan is meant to bring attention to the fact that nearly all jobs, regardless of the sector, depend directly on water. Cleaner water makes for a safer, more productive environment, results in healthier food, and contributes to a greener economy and sustainable development. But ensuring that people everywhere have access to all the clean water they need, where they need it, when they need it, reliably and sustainably, requires global cooperation. On this World Water Day, the United States remains steadfast in our commitment to achieving a water-secure future, and we invite all stakeholders to partner with us to save water and save lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.